From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, rates are going up, the number of plans is shrinking. What's ahead for the Affordable Care Act?
It is by far not a perfect law, but it's a foundation we can work from.
What does Proposal A mean for Detroit? One of its leaders answers the critics.
There's no history that community development agreements in 129 cities have stopped development at all from happening.
College students rooming with senior citizens in West Michigan.
I'm a very curious person, and I would like to talk to them and learn from them and maybe pass some my wisdom on to them, too.
And bicycles and front porches building neighborhood connections.
It is engaging neighbors in a conversation that they may not have otherwise.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How much voice should people have about a development proposed for their neighborhood? When a developer gets tax breaks or public funding towards a project, should the people living around that project get something? Those questions are at the heart of a pair of proposals on the ballot in Detroit, two competing community benefits ordinances, or CBOs. Proposal A came from a grassroots initiative led by neighborhood leaders and activists under the umbrella group Rise Together Detroit. And one of the leaders is here with us now. The Reverend Joan Ross is director of the North and Woodward Community Coalition. Good to have you back on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. It is good to be back on Michigan Radio and with you, of course.
What launched this push for a community benefits agreement?
Well, it's really simple. Proposal A says if we have to pay, we should have a say. Vote yes on A and no on B. And that's at the heart of what you're saying. If residents have to pay for these things, then isn't it right that we just have a say, that we're at the table during these negotiations? Since we're the ones that are impacted and that really have to live with this long after the developers are gone home.
Was there any specific project or was it a cumulative effect of many projects?
It's actually been a cumulative effect. You know, we've been working on this for about 3 years now, and it really started around the M1 project when we found that community didn't have a voice in that project. Once it died and it was no longer a light rail project, it seemed that the whole emphasis shifted from community actually being involved at all. We have in the North End a stop for that station, but we don't have boarding in the North End. So that began the conversation with City Council, then Council Member Joanne Watson and Brenda Jones, around why can't community have a say when development comes into their area? Why are we the ones asked to pay, asked to sacrifice, but no say at all? So that's where this started. We went to council members, and they, in 2013, long before this council was seated, long before this mayor was elected, and they felt the need to bring an ordinance into Detroit around community benefits. That's where Proposal A started. What we have on the ballot now is a mirror of what we have been working on with council for 3 years.
That didn't get through.
It laid there, Cynthia, with no action by the council. And one of the very members who proposed Proposal B, Scott Benson, was a member of that committee that kept a stall on Proposal A.
So here we are, voters being asked to make a choice come Election Day. Under Proposal A, developers of a project with a public and or private investment of at least $15 million and with $300,000 in tax breaks would have to negotiate a legally binding community benefits agreement. With whom? Who would they be negotiating with?
They would negotiate with the host community, where that census tract for that development is. A group would be selected. And, you know, a side thing to that is we've been training folks for the past 3 years in how to negotiate. That was one of the objections, that community wasn't strong enough or able to negotiate. And we've actually undertaken training classes in negotiation skills for communities all around the city. So when that development comes in, that host community selects who that negotiation team would be. And the deal would be strictly between the developer and the host community. Proposal A is really all about development. It is an encouragement for development. In the proposal, there are outs, if you will, should the community not be able to negotiate, should the community not be able to come together, then the developer can go back to the city council and say, this community is not functioning right.
Okay.
We want to move on with our project. So in the real sense, Proposal A is really pro-development. We want development to happen.
Does the ordinance block city officials and city council members from the community benefits agreements?
Well, actually, the city side, the city council and the mayor have already worked out a development agreement with that developer. So they've already done the hard nuts and bolts negotiation. This is strictly about community issues with that.
Why would they not be at the table?
Well, because they've already done their part.
Okay.
And we find that in their agreements, they have what's called clawbacks. If a developer doesn't live up to their agreements, they can claw back. But in all the history of DEGC, we've never seen a clawback. We saw one clawback happen, but it was pullback. So they have never said to the developer, you haven't kept your promises, therefore we're going to take back our abatement. This ordinance, Proposal A, actually gives the community power to say an enforceable agreement that you have not kept your promises to us. You got the money, but you didn't do what you said you were going to do. Therefore, we have recourse to go to court at our own cost.
What kinds of community benefits would the groups be asking for? And I'm getting the sense it depends on what group you're talking about and what neighborhood you're in. But give me an idea of the kinds of benefits.
Well, for instance, they could ask for housing to make sure that there wasn't displacement. They could ask for safety issues. Environmental issues would certainly be a very big one. We're not allowed to ask for jobs, but we can frame it so that we can encourage local businesses, small businesses within our communities to become involved in that development as well. So the major things are environmental issues, health issues, safety, and certainly housing and relocation. And for instance, there's recently an article in the Free Press about Midtown now trying to do a Stay Midtown program, which is a result of all the displacement that has happened in Midtown because of the development. Had there been a community benefit agreement in place, that would have happened along with the development. It wouldn't be a go back and fix this thing. It would be something that would be worked right into the development.
And legally binding.
And legally binding.
The negotiators from the neighborhood groups, critics will say, well, this means self-appointed unelected groups wind up deciding the fate of development projects and negotiating legally binding agreements.
Not really the fate of development projects. In the past years that Mayor Duggan has been in, there have been 55 development deals. Out of those 55 development deals, only 11 of them actually meet the guidelines of Proposal A. That is $15 million or greater with a public ask of $300,000. So actually, only 11 of those deals would have had community involvement, would have had community benefit agreements.
The rest are under that
threshold? The rest are under. And one is over. One is the $75 million that is actually proposed in Proposal B. That's only one agreement, or one deal out of those 55 deals. So only one time would community have been involved.
Because there are critics that feel that the dollar threshold is way too low for Proposal A and that it's going to have developers go, you know what, I'm not bothering, forget it.
Well, in the example I just gave you, in 55 deals, only 11 made the threshold of $15 million. So far more deals are under that don't really involve community benefit agreements. So I think that's a moot point right there, that only 11 and 55. Come on, what are we really talking about?
We have seen a strong push recently from union leaders urging voters to reject Proposal A. They are expressing very great fear that what is a well-intentioned effort is going to drive jobs and development dollars out of the city, and developers aren't going to want to deal with what some might call a bureaucratic nightmare. Is there any concern amongst Rise Together Detroit organizers that those people might be right, that in trying to help the city, it could wind up hurting?
I've got a couple of points there. First of all, when we look at the 55 deals that happened, we're told that 100,000 workers are saying this. But we look at the hockey arena, and yet they're fined because they can't find workers. So is there really 100,000 workers that say that? And many times we have the skilled trades people who are saying to us, they're not getting the jobs. They're being laid off in the 70 days or the 90 days. So they're not really meeting the guidelines of employing the skilled trades workers. So that's not the case. So we think that Proposal A is a way to give incentive to development. When you know a community is behind you and you're bringing a development, that's a lot of power in itself. That's a lot of easing of the red tapes. And remember, the big issues of the development will have been settled before a community comes to the table. There's a fear tactic that says the fear of loss is greater than the prospect of gain. And that's what we're hearing here, the fear of loss. There's no history that community development agreements in 129 cities have stopped development at all from happening in those cities.
As you referenced, the competing proposal sponsored by Councilman Scott Benson, Proposal B, that kick-in limit is $75 million and or tax breaks of at least $1 million, with neighborhood groups having advisory roles in the negotiations. So in your view, what's wrong with Proposal B?
Advisory boards are just that. They're advisory boards. They have no power at all. They don't even get to go to a meeting unless somebody calls the meeting. We've seen the advisory board system in both the hockey arena and the Whole Foods coming into Detroit. They do not work. And the other part there is it's selected by the planning department director. In Detroit, I doubt 10 people know the name of the planning department director. And if they don't know his name, chances are he doesn't know their name. And he's the one that actually selects that committee. So there's no people representation there. What it is another group. The mayor could do this right now. He could do everything that's in Proposal B right now. It doesn't need an ordinance. It really is no ordinance at all. These things are available to be done in Detroit right now, anytime.
The Detroit Free Press Editorial Board recommends saying no to both proposals, saying Detroiters deserve better than either Proposal A or Proposal B. What's your response to that? Did that surprise you?
No, it didn't surprise me. But if we vote no on both, we're no better off than we are right now. We have nothing. And we've had nothing for since 1974, in 50-some years. We've lived with this thought of that it's going to trickle down. People say, well, we'll go back and create something better. Council and the mayor had 3 years to work on this bill and make it better, and they haven't done that. So what would be those people's grounds for thinking it's going to get any better?
One of the top organizers of Proposal A before Detroit voters on Election Day, the Reverend Joan Ross, North End Woodward Community Coalition. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cynthia, for having me.
And later this week, we'll turn to one of the leaders in the campaign that's pushing for Proposal B.
There's always a balance between community benefits and then exactly how much you ask for before the developer decides to move somewhere else.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Their friends may have been moving back to dorms or apartments to start the new school year, but a group of occupational therapy students from Western Michigan University this fall moved their things into new rooms at the Clark Retirement Community on Keller Lake. It's one of the first research projects of its kind in the country, college students living side by side with senior citizens. A couple weeks after move-in day, we spoke with Nancy Hawk from the Department of Occupational Therapy at Western Michigan University. Where did you get this idea of mixing students and retirees this way?
Well, I actually went along with a colleague of mine who's actually my partner on this project, Dr. Maureen Micas, and we went on a study abroad trip to Ireland. We were looking at perspectives on aging, the differences between the two countries, in Ireland and in the U.S. And when I returned from that trip, I saw a posting on Facebook, actually, that talked about this type of scenario in the Netherlands. They had a housing shortage for students, and then they placed them in an underutilized nursing facility for geriatrics. And so I thought that was a great idea. Then I met the administrator of Clark at Keller Lake at a holiday party, and he was telling me about the facility and mentioned that he was an 80-bed facility, but actually 94, but only licensed for 80 beds. And I asked them if they would be interested in moving some OT students in there to fill the other beds, and this is where the whole thing started.
What a great light bulb to go on. So tell us a little about the Clark at Keller Lake community. What kind of care is offered there?
So it's an assisted living facility. They do have some independent living sites in condominiums around the main facility, but it has basically split into two 40-bed units that is assisted living. One is primarily for residents with dementia, and then the students are actually living in the non-dementia side of the facility.
And we're talking three students?
3 students.
And how were they chosen?
We actually interviewed students and sent out a message to my incoming students for the new year, and we had some students express interest, and then we interviewed them along with administration at the site and some of the residents from the facility, and then we selected the students and paired them up, and they moved in September.
How many girls, how many boys?
2 girls, 1 boy.
So how long will they live at the Clark community?
They're able to live there for 19 months, which would be their whole academic time in our program. We had originally decided to do a 9-month project, but then we had a Skype conversation with the students in the Netherlands that live in the facility, and they had mentioned it would take at least 6 months to develop strong relationships with the residents there. So we increased the time to their whole academic experience.
Clearly, you're hoping your students gain experiences that will make them better occupational therapists. So that would be part one of the goal?
That is part one. They will learn a great deal about geriatrics. And then also we're hoping that they develop some perspectives on aging and what old is and what older people are capable of doing. And then also hoping that they can each teach each other something, the residents teaching the students some things, and vice versa, the students teaching the residents some things.
Certainly. And then are you looking to get some research data to really pass on with everyone out of this experience?
Yes, we're using the age semantic differential. That's an assessment that evaluates their perspective of aging. And then we will do that assessment when they move in, and then again at 12 months, and then again at 19 months. And then we also have planned semi-structured interviews that we're doing with the students, the residents, and then any family members or staff that would also be willing to participate.
What do you hope the residents, these retirees, what do you hope they'll get out of living with these 3 students?
Well, when we spoke with the students from the Netherlands, they talked about how when they moved into the facility, that all the residents talked about what they used to do. I used to do this, I used to do that. When I was younger, I did that. And he really indicated that he wanted to give all the residents a now. And I think some of the things that the residents wanted to learn was, you know, information about Google or how to use the internet or technology. And then also to increase their activity level, maybe at off times in the evening and the weekends when maybe there aren't as many activities going on. And then for the students to develop relationships with these older adults.
It's going to be very fun to follow this group along with you and see how this all evolves. So you're going to have a lot of interesting insights to talk about in classes, I'm sure.
I will. And it's already been interesting. Already I can see trends in relationships that are developing.
Nancy Hawk is a professor of occupational therapy at Western Michigan University. Nancy, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Let's say hello now to one of the students and one of the retirees. Charlie Lundstrom is a resident at the Clark Retirement Community on Keller Lake. Charlie, hello.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. And we're happy to say hello to a first-year master's student at Western Michigan in occupational therapy, Colette Chapp. Good to have you with us, Colette.
Good to be here.
Why did you decide that you would apply to live at the Clark on Keller Lake?
I've always had a passion for the elderly population. And I've always known that I wanted to work with them in some capacity to learn more about them and increase the quality of life for that population. So when I first heard about this project, it just sounded so groundbreaking and unique, and I just knew that I had to be part of it.
Colette, what kind of reaction did your friends, not people maybe in the occupational therapy program, but other friends, what did they react to this idea?
They thought it was a little weird at first, but because my friends know my passion for this and they just know how drawn I am to service, and especially with the elderly population, they all thought that it was a perfect fit and they were really excited for me.
What were you looking forward to?
I think the thing that I was looking forward to the most is the relationships that would come from it. I think that by living there, I'll have so many relationships that I would never have had the opportunity to make in any other circumstance. So the relationships that I can make with these residents is the thing that I was most excited about. And then obviously what I could learn from those relationships and what I could take moving forward.
Now, was there anything you were a little uncertain about or unsure about going into this?
The thing that I was the most nervous about, I guess, going in was that really nobody will be able to relate to what I'm experiencing here. I have the 2 other students with me, so they'll be able to understand. But my friends and like my main support group won't have any idea what this feels like, especially throughout the 19 months as lots of things happen and I'm doing this at school. Really, nobody will be able to understand. So that's, I think, the thing that I'm the most worried about. But I think that it'll work itself out as it goes.
All right, let's get the residents' perspective. Charlie Lundstrom, what did you and other residents at Clark on Keller Lake think when you heard this news that you could be rooming with some college kids?
Well, we were surprised. I would say, not sure exactly what it was all about, but look forward to it. At least I did very much. I'm a very curious person, and I would like to talk to them and learn from them and maybe pass some my wisdom on to them, too.
And you were on the committee that helped decide which students could come live at Clark. I really like that idea that there was a residence committee. You kind of reviewed the applications and decided who would be a good fit. What were you looking for, Charlie?
Well, really, I was looking for just someone who was quite interested in integrating with older people and learning from us and also people that could teach us, that we could learn from them.
Now, we heard from Colette about aspects of what she was nervous with. What about you, or what did you hear from other residents? Were there any misgivings or things that people were uncertain about?
Well, I think there was some uncertainty because this is a new thing, and I think a lot of people just didn't understand, you know, what would happen with three younger people living with an older retired population. So there was some question in their minds, but I don't think it was any concern about anybody.
Well, and now there have been a couple of weeks that have happened. What are the first couple of weeks like? I'll start with you, Colette.
For me, it's been great so far. I have had the opportunity to get to know a couple of the residents. I would not say that I've gotten to know everybody yet. That is something that I'm looking forward to, getting to know more of the population. But so far, I've just really enjoyed integrating with them and like participating in the activities that they usually participate in and seeing where relationships go from there.
Okay, what kind of activities?
Well, every Wednesday I play poker. They taught me how to play poker, so that's been fun.
You're going to come away with some great life skills, Colette.
Yeah, that's one of the most important things. I've had a couple conversations with people. They've showed me their family pictures and things that they've worked on over the past few years. So that's the thing that I've spent the most time doing, I think. Also, I eat a lot of meals with the residents, so that's given me a lot of time with them.
And Charlie, how about you? What kind of interactions have you had in these first couple weeks?
Well, I had dinner last night with Lori. Now, she's the other gal student. She's one I interviewed, and I talked to her about her teaching me computer. I'm computer illiterate, and she had mentioned it. We had mentioned it when I interviewed her, and she was very happy to say that she would be happy to teach me how to be computer-wise. So I'm looking forward to that part of it, and I hope that in things I could tell them, too, that would help them.
I think it'll be interesting as this goes forward, as you all get to know each other, to find out what things are in common, the kinds of things, Charlie, that maybe you went through as you were starting out, you know, in life and finding out that, hey, maybe these years haven't made so much of a difference. What did you do, Charlie, before you retired?
I was an attorney here in Grand Rapids for 36 years. I came here in 1958 and left in 1994. I practiced law here with Warner Norcross and Judd for 36 years. And thoroughly enjoyed it.
That'll make for some interesting conversations. Colette, why did you choose occupational therapy?
I actually started out thinking that I was going to do some type of career involving psychology. That's what I have my bachelor's degree in. But as I went and I learned more about it, I realized that I really needed something more hands-on, that I could form more personal relationships with the people that I work with and really use myself in their therapy and working with them. So that's what drew me to occupational therapy, is how tangible of a result you can have with your relationship with somebody.
Well, it'll be interesting. We're going to be checking in with both of you as this year goes on. We'll see how things go. We'll hear if your poker skills are getting better and better, Colette and Charlie.
I hope so.
We look forward to hearing and maybe getting some email from you and knowing that the computer skills are rubbing off as well.
I hope so.
Charlie Lundstrom and Colette Chapp, we want to thank you both for speaking with us, and we will be checking in with you as this period goes on. A great, great research project. So good luck to both of you. We'll talk with you soon.
Thank you very much.
The Night Cities Challenge. It's a chance for 26 Knight Foundation communities across the country, including Detroit, to answer this question. What's your best idea to make cities more successful? At stake is a share of $5 million in grants.
The things that drive city success are economic opportunity, talent, and civic engagement. So we're really looking for those ideas that are somehow advancing those three criteria for a successful city.
That's Katie Locker. She's the Knight Foundation Program Director for Detroit. She says the Knight City's challenge is open to anyone as long as you've got an idea that benefits Detroit.
And we make it really easy to apply. You only have to answer three questions, and each answer can only be 100 words long. So you have 300 words to answer these questions, and that's it for submitting and testing your idea.
Applications will be accepted through November 3rd at knightcities.org. Let's take a closer look now at one of those winning ideas. It's called Pedal to Porch. It uses biking to connect neighbors through community conversations on porches. The idea? To break through some of the barriers that we have about talking to each other in our own neighborhoods. Cornetta Lane is founder of Pedal to Porch. She and her team won a $30,000 Knight Cities Challenge grant this year. Tell us, how does Pedal to Porch work?
Pedal to Porch is a neighborhood bike ride that includes stops along a route where residents of the neighborhood use their front porch as a stage to tell their story. So we have about 50 people that show up to a neighborhood hub, and we leave there, and we go to the first house. The storyteller gets 5 minutes to share their story, and then we're off to the next house. And we usually have about 5 people to share their stories.
What kind of stories do you hear?
Usually they are stories about the neighborhood history, or stories about their fondest memories living on the block, or their stories about, you know, even social justice. So they range the gamut.
How many neighborhoods have you been able to get Pedal to Porch launched in?
So far, we've hosted Pedal to Porch in a total of 3 neighborhoods. The first neighborhood was in my neighborhood, which is called Core City. And the whole purpose was to preserve the historical identity of Core City because it was in danger of being rebranded. And then the second one was in Southwest Detroit, and it was lifting up the activists that are and artists that are in that neighborhood just to showcase the beautiful diversity that is in Southwest Detroit. And then the last one was over on the east side along the Mac and Alter corridor that border Grosse Pointe. And that whole the whole purpose there was to kind of create a dialogue between Detroit and Grosse Pointe.
Why was it you thought the Knight Cities grant was a good fit for Pedal to Porch?
Well, their main mission was around civic engagement. And that's exactly what Pedal to Porch is. It is engaging neighbors in a conversation that they may not have otherwise. There's been a lot of studies that show that folks don't know their neighbors anymore. They don't know their names. They don't know their stories. And so the best way to kind of do that is to kind of host a bike ride through the neighborhood, introducing neighbors to each other.
So that $30,000 Knight Cities Challenge grant you won, what have you been able to do with that grant money?
Yes, so much. Not only is it the money that has allowed me to host in the different neighborhoods, but it's also the network. So, and I come into a room and I say, you know, this is Pedal to Porch and I'm supported by the Knight Foundation, I kind of get some respect in the room.
Some good street cred, right?
yeah. It gives us a little bit more access and a little bit more validation. And so not only has, you know, the Knight Foundation grant allowed us to do Pedal to Porch over the summer, but we have enough funds to do it a second summer. And then we're also expanding to different cities. So last week, we were in D.C. To meet with some community members there who are interested in bringing Pedal to Porch to D.C. There's also an ask to come to Boston. So we're looking to bring Pedal to Porch to cities around the U.S.
Pedal to Porch is presenting a docu-series, Peddler. It's a story about neighborhoods in Detroit from the voices of its residents. And a community conversation will follow the premiere. And it'll be Thursday, October 27th at 6 p.m. at 1725 Lawndale Street in Detroit. So docu-series, that series implies there might be more?
Yes. So after the Pedal to Porch experience, because we cap the bike ride at 50 people, we want to be able to continue that conversation and to kind of bring those stories out to a larger group of people. So we filmed each of the bike rides, and now we're hosting a premiere. So the first premiere will be over in Southwest, and then the second film will be shown over on the east side.
And again, that's Thursday, October 27th, 6 p.m., and the address is 1725 Lawndale Street in Detroit. Cornetta Lane, the founder of Pedal to Porch. What a great idea, Cornetta.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We got word from the federal government this week. Premiums for popular health plans sold on healthcare.gov are going up across the country, an average of 25%. And depending upon where you live, you may have fewer choices when you shop on the exchange. What will we see in Michigan, and what does this all say about the health of the Affordable Care Act? Marianne Udall Phillips is director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan Health System. Marianne, you and I have had a lot of conversations on Stateside about the ACA through these years. You've been a pretty big proponent of the ACA. How concerned are you about these rising costs and shrinking options?
I am a supporter of the ACA because I think it's better than what we had before. And I think it's really important for us to understand that for people who buy their coverage as individuals, the market was broken before the Affordable Care Act was in effect. The market is actually better now, even with these rate increases for people who buy the coverage themselves. It's not perfect. It does need to be fixed. There are problems with it, but it's a place to start from. And that's always been my feeling about the Affordable Care Act. It is by far not a perfect law, but it's a foundation we can work from.
So hearing this, you know, the news that, you know, rates going up, we've got some insurers dropping out. Why is that? Were customers older and sicker than everybody thought they might be at the beginning?
Right. To some degree, health plans enrolled people that were sicker than they expected, and their rates, they set their rates lower than they should have for that population. Mm-hmm. To some degree, some of the health plans thought they were going to get some more what's called risk stabilization support from the federal government, and some of those funds did not fully materialize the way health plans expected that they would. And there were some changes in the way the federal government tried to encourage people to enroll. So federal government had a very generous policy for allowing people to enroll in what's called special enrollment periods.
Come into the tent.
Right.
Yeah.
They really wanted to get a lot of people covered. And so they made it easy for people to enroll even after those special enrollment, after the formal enrollment periods were over. And many health plans feel that people who enrolled in those periods were sicker, they dropped coverage shortly after they got a particular problem addressed, and that made their whole risk pool sicker than they expected.
So what does this mean going forward? Do you think this is more of a market correction, or is there a sign that there is deep trouble?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. The federal government has already, to some degree, improved some of those policies that it had, at least from the health plan's perspective. They tightened up the special enrollment period, not to the point the insurers would like to see it yet, so there's still dialogue going on about that. To some degree, these rate changes are reflecting more about who's in the pool, but there's still a lot of concern that if healthy people do not sign up, then those risk pools get worse, rates go up higher, and fewer people sign up, and more people are willing to pay the penalty. And so it's something that I really do think Congress will need to look at. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that will happen after this election, that people will actually sit down and figure out how can we improve this design because there are problems with it.
And when we say the healthier people, does that harken back to conversations you and I have had about getting younger people?
That's right. You've got the young people need to come in, mm-hmm. and people who are relatively healthy need to come in. And for some of them, they've been willing to pay the penalties. Those penalties are going up. And so
more of having them, no insurance.
That's
just
right.
Going there. Yeah.
That's right. And so more of them may start to come in just because of those penalties over time. But the insurers never thought those penalties were high enough. They always wanted them to be higher. So there's really a dialogue that needs to go on at the policy level to see how can we fix these problems. This is a market-based system. It's a complicated system, and it's much harder to make a market-based system work everywhere across the country than it is to make a single-payer system work like they have in most of European countries.
I know it was earlier this month we learned Michigan consumers are going to pay nearly 17% more for individual insurance plans and small group plans, about 2.5%. Does right. that fit with what?
So it's complicated, right?
Yes.
So the average rate filing went up about 16.2% in the individual market, but that doesn't actually mean that's what people will pay, and
right.
that's really important to understand.
And the same for this 25% increase that we're hearing about nationally.
That's absolutely right.
And we're hearing officials in Washington are saying, you know, well, as premiums go up, more Americans will be eligible for the tax credits.
That's right.
In fact, I see more than 8 in 10 consumers will be qualifying for ACA subsidies.
That's right. In Michigan, 87% of those who enrolled last year got a tax credit. And for those people, what happens is the tax credit goes up as the cost
yeah.
goes up. So,
but doesn't that mean the ACA is being propped up by we, the taxpaying public?
Well, it always has been. So the yeah. tax credits were designed to help people who are at relatively low income make health care more affordable. That mm-hmm. is part of the design. This is partially a tax-funded system of health insurance, same as Medicaid. It's a tax-funded system. People also pay. That is how, you know, premium. So that's mm-hmm. it's a combination of things. And in fact, even with these rate increases and the higher subsidies the federal government will pay this year, costs are still lower than what the Congressional Budget Office and most people predicted healthcare spending would be at this time. And so net, the federal government over the past 3 years in total will be paying out less in subsidies than they actually had expected, because the first 2 years were very, very low in terms of healthcare cost increases.
Now, let's ask a question on behalf of the consumers who don't qualify for tax subsidies.
Yes.
Tough darts?
Well, they should shop around.
Okay.
So, in fact, the average premium goes up 16.2% of all the health plans, but for the second lowest cost silver plan, the average premium goes up 7%. And so people really need to look at the choices in their area, and particularly if they live in urban areas, they're going to have choices. It may mean they have to change health plans, but they probably won't have to pay an increase, even if you're not getting a subsidy. They may not have to pay an increase of 16%.
All right, two things there. If you're not in an urban area, I know, for example, you and I have talked about in
yes.
the Upper Peninsula, Schoolcraft County, there's only one choice.
That's right.
There's
That's
not much
right.
shopping around you can do.
That's right.
A lot of counties only have two.
That's right.
So what about the people where there really isn't much of a choice?
That's right. So Mackinac County is yeah. the county in Michigan that had the biggest drop in the number of plans that are offered from 2016. 2016 in Mackinac County, they had 26 different plans from one carrier, from Blue Cross and Blue Shield, but 26 plans to choose from. In 2017, they only have 14 plans, but that's still 14 choices. Mm-hmm. So they may not, even though they only have one carrier, they may not actually have to pay a 16% rate increase if they choose a plan that has a more limited network of doctors and hospitals.
That's the other question. What happens if I do shop around and I get a plan that is lower? What am I losing out?
That's right. You may have to change doctors or hospitals, because the way that these health plans are keeping their costs lower is by having what's called narrower networks of doctors and mm-hmm. hospitals. And that is a challenge. And that is a challenge for many consumers, especially consumers who have medical needs, a lot of medical needs. That's hard for them to make those kinds of changes.
As you know very well, all through this campaign, we've heard people on both sides of the aisle criticizing the ACA. We even got a blast across the bow from Bill Clinton.
We did.
We've had others say they want to kill it. Do you think this latest news really feeds those anti-ACA flames?
Well, certainly it increases the headlines around this issue and does feed those who have wanted to repeal it. And again, what I would say is repealing doesn't fix this problem, because the problem predates the Affordable Care Act. What the Affordable Care Act gives us is a platform to work from. In this structure, there are still many people who are getting health insurance coverage who could not afford it before, and they can afford it now, especially if you're getting a tax credit. You know, 73% of people in Michigan will have to pay less than $100 a month for health insurance in 2017, because so many people get tax credits. And so it is still more affordable for many people, not for everyone. And we need to figure out that other piece, because that is very important.
And what do you think, let's say, you know, we're now, let's look past November 8th. We're going to have a new president. What kind of adjustments and fixes do you think need to be looked at by our next president?
Well, there have been a lot of proposals that are on the table, and we'll have to see what the politics look like. But certainly some of the discussions that need to happen, some of them are regulatory, like these issues around the special enrollment period. Can those things be tightened up? There have been proposals about expanding the tax credits to give people more financial support, more people more financial support. There have been proposals. President Obama just recently proposed that in communities where there aren't many choices or no choices, that we allow a public option, which means people would be allowed to buy Medicare coverage, for example. And that was an issue that was debated when the Affordable Care Act was first passed and wasn't included at that time. But I think that's going to be back on the table for discussion. So there's going to be more discussion about how do you make the market more competitive? How do you get more people in? I think there could be discussion about the penalties and whether or not they are high enough to really get people to enroll. So I think there are going to be a lot of things that are put on the table. And
is the political will there to tackle those?
That's the question.
Things.
Hopefully it'll be beyond the let's just repeal it, because that it's probably not going to be repealed. Almost no matter what happens, it's unlikely to be totally repealed. It would really be so much more beneficial for everyone in the country if we could figure out how to improve it. And there are many ideas out there about how to improve it.
Marianne Udall-Phillips is director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan Health System. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's delightful to be here, Cindy, as always.
To many, it seems like these are angry, unhappy times in America, in our world. A new book offers an antidote, The Book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World. It brings us wisdom from two of the world's leading spiritual leaders, Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama. It chronicles a conversation between the two, sharing their stories and best teachings for creating long-lasting joy and happiness. And the book pairs their thoughts with scientific research. One of the studies in the book centers on the importance of forgiveness and compassion. With us now is the Hope College psychology professor who did the study. In fact, she has been studying forgiveness and compassion for some two decades. Charlotte Van Ooyen-Whitfleet, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Tell us a little about your history of researching forgiveness. What drew you to it?
I had been drawn to thinking about forgiveness really since I was very young. And I learned the tools of my trade, psychological research, studying emotion and physiology while in graduate school. I was training in a clinical psychology PhD program, and I was working clinically with people who almost always had some sort of interpersonal injustice that had hurt them. So I brought together my training in clinical psychology and my research formation as someone who studied emotion and its physiological elements, and I brought that together with my concern for how people can respond to the relational wrongs and wounds in their everyday lives.
All right. So talk to us about the study that you did that was included in the Book of Joy. Can you give us kind of a simple explanation of the questions you were answering and what you've learned?
Yes, thank you. That very first study we ever did in our forgiveness lab asked people to identify a specific person who they held responsible for having caused a wrong or a hurt in that relationship. They then thought about that specific offense and that specific offender in four different ways. The two unforgiving responses involved sort of remembering, reliving, rehashing, ruminating, as well as grudge holding. On the other hand, we also had two more forgiving responses, one of which involved some empathic perspective taking about the humanity of the offender, and then the forgiveness, which aimed to find even a small way to wish the offender well in the growth, learning, or change that was needed.
Tell us what happened when people focused on the empathy and the letting go and forgiving exercise.
Well, we found many emotional and physiological side effects of that sort of moral response. We found a shift away from negative and toward positive emotion. We found that people were calmer, that they perceived that they were more in control. They certainly experienced more empathy and forgiveness. And physiologically, their faces were calmer. Their brows were less furrowed. The muscles under their eyes were less tensed. Their sweat levels were able to drop off, as they do as people become more calm in the laboratory. Their heart rates were less reactive and more calm, and their blood pressure was also less reactive.
That's really, really striking. And did you really see that so clearly? Did it just jump right out at you?
It was undeniable statistically, and we were very happy that another lab in Tennessee, shortly after using a different kind of approach to studying this, found very similar results. And we have since published 4 experiments that have replicated the effects of what we now call compassionate reappraisal in comparison to rumination about those old hurts.
So in essence, when we keep stewing over those past hurts, we're picking at that emotional scab. That keeps us churned up. And then when I think about the Book of Joy, it seems like this is the scientific backdrop to so many spiritual beliefs, such as turning the other cheek or, you know, let he who is without sin cast the first stone.
It's really important, I think, that what we're doing is trying to see more of the truth, not less. We're trying to see the truth of the offender's humanity and have a clear-eyed view of the wrongdoing and its implications. But we also then have the opportunity to see that wrongdoing as evidence that this offender needs to change, to grow, to learn. And even if we can't remain in a relationship with this person because it may not be healthy or safe to do so, we can still desire that good change in the offender.
Well, it certainly is the kind of mindset that belongs in the Book of Joy when you consider these two spiritual leaders, Archbishop Tutu and the Dalai Lama. What does it mean for you personally to be a part of this book, the Book of Joy?
Well, it was such an interesting opportunity because in the year 2010, I had been at the concluding event of a happiness project that had been through Emory. And there were many different interfaith leaders. And so at that time, what was so striking is to realize that interfaith conversations do address areas of common concern, such as compassion, such as forgiveness, but also address those honest areas of difference. And I think in the Book of Joy, you see both those areas of common concern, but you also see the particularities of each tradition shining through. And their friendship shows that they have listened well to each other and can see those particularities, those differences, and those shared areas of concern.
Charlotte Van Ooyen-Whitfleet is a professor of psychology at Hope College. Her research on forgiveness and compassion is included in the Book of Joy, Conversations Between the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World. Charlotte, we want to thank you so much for sharing your work with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. A pleasure.
Detroiter Andrea Clark turned personal tragedy into a movement for peace.
It doesn't matter how your child was murdered, whether he was the drug dealer or the man standing on the corner and got robbed for his glasses or whatever. All mothers who have lost a child to violence and to murder, I welcome them in our group because our children are on the same level right now. They're not here.
And that's Stateside for today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Cynthia Canty.